Greitens went to Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar to study humanitarianism. He finished his PhD there, then joined the Navy SEALs and served tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, where he was awarded a Purple Heart and a Bronze Star. When he returned to the States, he founded The Mission Continues, an agency that helps wounded veterans use their leadership and public service skills at home. And he's written a book about all that called The Heart and the Fist, The Education of a Humanitarian, The Making of a Navy SEAL. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. I'm very pleased that it brings Eric Greitens to our show today. Hello.
Leonard, pleasure to be on with you.
So how did you originally get interested in doing humanitarian work?
Well, you know, I was very fortunate growing up, Leonard. I had a lot of teachers who involved me in community service. And then I later had a teacher when I was in college who invited me to go to Bosnia to work with Bosnian refugees. And I went to work with unaccompanied children, children who were survivors of the ethnic cleansing but had been separated from their parents. And that was my first real experience of doing international humanitarian work.
And then you went to a number of other devastated places?
I did. I later went to Rwanda, where I worked with survivors of the genocide. I worked in Cambodia with children who'd lost limbs to landmines. I worked in Bolivia with children who were children of the street. And I also worked in India with some of Mother Teresa's missionaries of charity, who worked with the destitute and dying in places like Varanasi, India.
Were you being sent by different organizations?
I would often,
because you couldn't afford to do that all by yourself.
No, I could not afford to do it by myself. What I was doing is I was volunteering with those organizations, and then I was also serving as a documentary photographer for them as well as a volunteer, and I was able to pay for that travel with documentary photography grants.
Did you find some humanitarian organizations to be more effective than others?
Absolutely. And in the Heart and the Fist, I talk about a lot of the lessons that I learned about how to do effective international humanitarian work. I saw, for example, an organization called the Cambodia Trust in Cambodia, which worked with children who'd lost limbs to landmines. And a lot of the work that they did at the Cambodia Trust was incredibly effective, not just because of what they gave to the children, but because of what they asked of them. And they asked those kids who'd lost limbs to landmines to stand up, to start to serve again, and to become leaders in their community.
Well, I would assume that NGOs that work specifically with children face challenges that other groups might not.
Absolutely. One of the challenges that NGOs face who work with children is that they oftentimes, when you set up programs specifically for children, you can have a tendency to divide children from their families. So, for example, in Rwanda, in The Heart and the Fist, I write about this process where an orphanage was set up for unaccompanied children. Well, at the time, there was tremendous devastation in Rwanda, 1.2 million refugees living on this volcanic plain, and a lot of desperate families ended up sending their children to the orphanage even though their parents were actually alive. And so nonprofit organizations have to be really careful when they're working in those situations to support those families.
Well, most of these children haven't had childhoods. They have experienced traumatic events. In some cases, they've been enlisted to be child soldiers.
That's right.
I wonder what life is like for somebody who has started killing at the age of 11 or 12.
It's absolutely a different idea of what a childhood is like than what we think of it in the United States of America. You know, one of the things that I saw when I was working with kids, for example, who were children of the street in Bolivia, is that these kids were coming from a background of devastation that a lot of us just had no experience of. And so it took a really disciplined approach. It took this kind of courageous, compassionate, heart and fist approach to really be able to work with those kids effectively.
Is this something you can study in college?
You know,
I mean, you went on a you were selected to be a Rhodes Scholar, and am I right that you got a degree in humanitarianism?
Yeah, so I actually wrote my PhD dissertation on international humanitarian work and on the most effective kinds of international humanitarian work. And there was a lot of good academic study that I could do at Oxford, but the reason why I think my education was valuable is because I was able to combine that time in the classroom with some really hard time doing that work in the field.
Well, I'm assuming most of the other people who were studying in similar programs were not very hands-on. They were just being theoretical. Is that a problem in the field?
It's always better whenever people have their hands on an issue. There's just no way to really relate to a kid who's lost a limb to a landmine in Cambodia, or to relate to a refugee family and really understand what's happening to somebody who survived a genocide unless you've been there, you've talked with them, and you've heard their stories. And it's those stories that really influenced the way that I started to think about international humanitarian work.
But you didn't go back and work for one of the NGOs after Oxford. You joined the Navy SEALs.
I did.
Now, that doesn't seem like the next natural step.
You know, I had this moment, which I talk about in the book, where I was working in Bosnia, and I was with a man who told me that these terrible things had been done to his family. And I was sitting with him in the shelter, and he explained to me that his wife had been raped, that his children had been attacked. He wasn't sure whether or not his parents and his sister were alive. And he said to me, you know, we appreciate the shelter that the international community's provided for us. We appreciate the food for my family. I appreciate the fact that there's a kindergarten here for my children. He said, but if you really cared about us, you'd be willing to protect us. And it was then that I saw that we make these distinctions between military responses and humanitarian aid, but if we really care about someone, if we really love them, certainly we're willing to care for them and be compassionate, but we also have to be willing to protect them.
But there's been a lot of talk about having the military engage in this sort of thing. It's not really part of the preparation. It's not something that you learn in basic training. And I remember reading about people in Kosovo saying, you know, when I signed up, I didn't think I was going to be helping somebody get a refrigerator.
That's exactly
right. It was said in a resentful way.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that the military has had to do, especially since September 11th, is adapt the way that we work. And when I was serving in Iraq and Afghanistan and Southeast Asia and the Horn of Africa, a lot of the work that we do is actually based on the idea of building relationships with people, because it's only when you've really built relationships with people in the local community that you can actually create peace.
My guest is Eric Greitens, G-R-E-I-T-E-N-S. His book, The Heart and the Fist, The Education of a Humanitarian, The Making of a Navy SEAL, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. You describe the part of the Navy SEAL training known as Hell Week in great detail in this book. What was the point of all that grueling training in which you weren't allowed to even sleep?
Well, you're right. It is. It's grueling training. And in my class, for example, we started with over 220 people and graduated with 21. And over the course of that training, they ask you to do things like swim 50 meters underwater, swim down 50 feet and tie a knot. They tie your feet together and tie your hands behind your back and make you jump in the pool and swim 50 meters. And all of that training is designed not just to induce fear, but to help people learn how to deal with their fear so that they can work in really difficult situations.
So were you able to apply any of that later?
Absolutely. I mean,
Houdini probably would have been helped by that.
You know, there was a tremendous amount that came out of that training. And what was interesting was as you go through that Navy SEAL training, what you learn is that they're not just teaching you tactical skills and things about physical strength, but they're really trying to teach you mental and moral skills as well, so that you can emerge from that being a true warrior who is able to bring a whole set of skills onto the battlefield.
You'd had a privileged academic background to the point that you joined the SEALs. Was there a culture clash between you and any of your fellow SEALs who probably were younger than you as well?
Oh, yeah. Most of the guys in my class were much younger than me. By the time I actually went to SEAL team training, I was 26. And one of the things, I remember that transition vividly from going from Oxford University, where I was defending my dissertation, and I had a couple of Oxford dons who were asking me about my theory of ideas, to going to Navy Officer Candidate School, where I had a drill sergeant screaming in my ear about whether or not I was able to tie my shoes correctly. So it was this big transition, and it was certainly a culture shock for me, but it was wonderful for me to actually get back into that training and do work with an incredible group of men and women.
Now, did you think that you were going to be going as a warrior or as someone who's going to be doing humanitarian things?
Well, no, I anticipated fully that when I went into Navy SEAL training that I would be leading people in combat. And when I saw what was happening in Bosnia, in Rwanda, when I was working in Albania at a time when refugees were coming down from Kosovo, that was my intention.
And you finished your Navy SEAL training just days before 9/11. How do you think that changed your sense of mission and the sense of mission for the other people who'd gone through the training with you?
I write about that in the book. It was a tremendous day that really changed our whole class's conception of what we were going to do. That morning when we emerged from a swim and ran over to the chow hall, by the time we stood up from chow, we knew that our whole class was going to war. And it really changed our mindset, and it changed the mindset of everyone who was in the SEAL teams at the time.
And you were going to go to Afghanistan?
Yes.
Is that where you got your Purple Heart or your Bronze Star?
Actually, the Purple Heart came from my service in Iraq. When I was serving in Iraq in March of 2007, my team was hit by a suicide truck bomb. I was serving.
That was an IED or a different? That's a suicide.
Yeah, it was a suicide truck bomb, exactly. And my job there, I was a commander of an Al-Qaeda targeting cell. And our job was to capture senior Al-Qaeda leaders in and around Fallujah. And in March of 2007, my team was hit by a suicide truck bomb. I was very fortunate in that my wounds were minor. I was treated at the Fallujah Surgical Hospital, and I was able to return to duty just a few days later. But several of the other guys on my team were hurt far worse than I was.
And we've been hearing about a lot of people who may not have been hurt physically by those kinds of things, but wind up suffering from PTSD. Do you have any idea why or maybe you do suffer from PTSD, but I suspect you don't.
No, I'm very fortunate in that I came back and I do not have post-traumatic stress disorder. But as you said, Leonard, many of the veterans who are returning do have post-traumatic stress disorder or some other psychological injury that they need to overcome.
Have any theories of how you escape that?
You know, I think one of the things for me was that there's a theory about stress inoculation, and I talk about that a little bit, about the way that when you're subjected to repeated stresses, you can actually become inoculated to the effect that they have on you. And I had been working in places like Bosnia and Rwanda and Cambodia since I was 19 years old. And by the time I actually was serving in Iraq there, I was 31 years old when I was deploying.
So you'd had a certain amount of preparation.
Exactly.
When you got out of active duty, you came back to the States and talked with wounded veterans. What did they want to do next?
What was really interesting to me was when I came home, and as I said, I was very fortunate in that my injuries were minor. I went to Bethesda to the Naval Hospital to visit with some of our recently returned wounded Marines. And as I walked into that hospital room, you ask these young men and women a little bit about their hometown. You ask them about their deployment. You ask them about their unit. And then you say to them, tell me what you want to do when you recover. And every single one of them says to you, I want to return to my unit. The reality was, though, for the men and women who I was seeing that day, was that they weren't going to be able to return to their unit. One of them had lost both of his legs. Another had lost the use of his right arm and his right lungs. Another had lost his hearing. So I said to each one of them, I said, well, tell me what else you'd like to do if you can't return to your unit. And every single one of them told me that they wanted to find a way to continue to serve.
And are there ways they can continue to serve?
Absolutely. And so when I left the hospital that day, what I did was I donated my combat pay. I asked two friends to put in money from their disability checks to start The Mission Continues. And what we do at The Mission Continues is that we create opportunities for wounded and disabled veterans to continue their service to our country by working with nonprofits and charitable organizations here at home.
There have been a number of scandals, Walter Reed Hospital for a while, elsewhere, about veterans either having to wait a long time to get any treatment or getting shoddy treatment. And now with Congress cutting back on funding for all sorts of things, how do you think the country is dealing and taking care of its veterans?
Well, you know, one of the things that I talk about is that I've learned a lot of lessons about how we work with veterans from the international humanitarian work that I did. And one of the things that I learned doing that work is that in order for people to overcome tragedy, in order for people to kind of meet the problems that they're facing in the front lines of their lives, it takes a whole community. And so there's certainly a role for the Department of Defense. There's certainly a role for the VA to play in their recovery. But it's also incredibly important that we mobilize communities to come out and to find ways to work with and reintegrate veterans into our society here at home.
Do you recommend that people give to international aid organizations?
I recommend that they give to quality international aid
organizations. Well, how do they know which ones are good and which ones aren't?
Yeah, one of the best things that you can do is to actually, first of all, if you know some people who've actually done international aid, that's a great way to get some recommendations. In The Heart and the Fist, I talk about some of the best organizations who I've worked with. It's also the case that there are some really good resources online where people can go out and they can research the finances of international organizations and they can get recommendations out there about who's doing really quality work.
I haven't asked you about your thoughts about the efforts in Afghanistan and Iraq, but do you want to talk about that for a moment?
Sure. Well, I was...
We're going to pull out, in theory, of Iraq soon and supposedly, we're going to be leaving Afghanistan in a little while, declaring victory.
Yes.
Can we declare victory?
Well, in Iraq, I can tell you that the situation has changed incredibly from when I was there. When I was serving there in 2006 to 2007, every time the Marines left the compound in Fallujah, they would get sniper shots, small arms fire, an IED would go off. Now, they've been able to really successfully turn the whole city over to the Iraqis, and there's the difference between what was happening in 2006 and 2007 and what's happening today is really a night and day difference. So there's certainly a tremendous amount of stability in Iraq. Afghanistan is a very different story. And when I talk with my friends who are currently deployed over there, there's really a lot of mixed messages from the battlefield about whether or not we've really been able to effectively deal with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
We have very little time, but I understand you've taught courses on leadership and public service. What do you think makes a good leader?
I think one of the things that makes a good leader is you have to have, first of all, you have to have rock-solid integrity. And two, you have to be serving a higher purpose. And in The Heart and the Fist, I talk a lot about how I try to build that sense of purpose through humanitarian work, through the combat deployments, how meaningful that's been in my life, and how we find that it's meaningful now in the lives of the wounded and disabled veterans who we work with.
Are you going to be writing more books?
I will be. I hope to soon. Right now, my efforts are just on getting The Heart and the Fist out into the world, but I look forward to it.
And Eric Greitens will be reading and signing books tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store on 86th Street and Lexington Avenue. The Heart and the Fist, the title is quite obvious. I guess I don't have to ask you how you came up with it.
You know, it was actually a wonderful suggestion from my editor. We were trying to think of a title that could bring together the idea of humanitarian SEAL stuff, and it was his idea.
And it's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Thank you so much, Eric Greitens, for being on our show today.
Thank you, Leonard.